welcome to another episode of Disrupt Ed, where we talk about the disruptions going on in this 5G wired, workforce augmented, technology interconnected, globally interdependent, AI accelerated, industry 4.0 advanced, pandemic interrupted, world of work. Now, here's the thing. You know, I talk to business owners and executives all the time. And some of them will tell me, I don't know if I should come on your podcast. I don't know if what I have to say is all that interesting. Well, you know, what I say to that is look around the room. I was recently at a workforce summit in downtown Detroit, and all you had to do is look around the room to see the leader in the group. This was a gentleman that you're going to want to hear from. His name is Alfonso Hall. And as we get talking, you're going to be amazed at his story and the kinds of things he's doing in this disrupted world of logistics and advanced manufacturing to make his business viable, to make his business a growth organization, and also to address what is a near crisis with so many of you out in the world of work, which is a very, very pronounced talent crisis, right? We are all struggling. Every business is struggling. In a recent poll, over 70% of business executives and leaders said that talent was their biggest barrier to growth. And so we're going to be talking about talent today. We're going to be talking about a lot of things, but we're going to be talking to a great individual I had the pleasure of meeting, Alfonso Hall, who is the president, CEO, and owner of a logistics and manufacturing company called Wolverine Assemblies. Al, welcome to the show. It is so great to finally have you on here after meeting and having several conversations about
this. Thank you, Ron. Thank you so much.
So, Al, I want to start out by asking you a question. You know, when you think about that intro, 5G wired world, those are all the disrupted forces going on all at the same time. And we were talking about this in your office a couple weeks ago, where you said, you know, never in your career or lifetime had so many things been disrupted or changing as fast, as quickly, and as abundantly as it is right now. And so maybe you could share with our audience, you know, in your line of work in the logistics and manufacturing area, what is the thing that you find most disrupted about your industry and about your organization's response to it?
You know, first of all, I'd like to once again thank you, Ron, for having me on, and hopefully what I have to say will be interesting to your viewers. You know, this is a changing environment, and it's changing so rapidly. And it's almost like a book that was written called Managing Chaos. It's a very, very chaotic time, but I think it's a very good time. You know, when you look at the technology is changing so fast. You look at AI and what AI is bringing to the table. You look at labor and and how we attract labor and how we maintain and keep that labor. Is such a challenge, but it is a good challenge to have, because what it does is make us become more creative. And as we all say, think outside of the box on what we can do to maintain not just the perfect labor, but individuals that you have to grow with, work with, to become what your corporation needs. So when I look at,
you know, that makes a lot of sense.
So when I look at this disruptive, I look at it from a point of opportunity, an opportunity to do something a little different that will reap you even greater benefits. So that's I talk technology and labor.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think what I found so interesting when we were at a workforce summit together talking about some of the talent challenges, there is no one that wasn't riveted to your discussion in the room about the kinds of very practical, very day-to-day things that you've changed up in order to not only attract people to your business, but also kept them happy, kept them loyal, and kept them really excited about being part of the growth story of Wolverine Assembly. So I think that's what we want to talk about. But before we do that, I got to tell you, I found you to be, and I told you this, and you blushed when I said it, but it's so true. You're such an interesting dude. And I also told, I may have told you this, I can't but remember, but you know, I grew up very uncool, very nerdy. And as I was getting older, I tried to be cool, never sort of took. And then I thought I was getting to a more cool state in my life. And then my two teenage boys said, no, dad, it's not working for you. You're face up to the fact you're never going to be cool. So I kind of pivoted at that point, and I said, you know what? I'm never going to be cool, but I'm going to be cool adjacent. I'm going to make sure that the cool cats in the room want to hang out with me. And so that's how I think I was able to convince you ultimately to get on the show, is because I look for cool people, and I try to be cool adjacent in the middle of that conversation. Yeah. So,
you know,
Ron,
when I try to be cool, my kids tell me I didn't make the mark either. So what I say about you, I like where your heart and your perspective is. And I think it's people like you that are trailblazers, and we need more of you. And we want you to continue to do what you do, because when you speak, you're not speaking on a platform for those that have. You are speaking on a platform for those that have and those that have not. And I think that's interesting, because sometimes we have what I call invisible people. What is an invisible person? It's a guy that was incarcerated 25 years ever since he was 16 to 17 and never learned how to work. What is an invisible person? It's an immigrant that's coming to this country, don't speak the language, but has a family that he or she has to take care of. What is an invisible person? It's a woman, a single mother, living in a poverty-stricken area, but want to break the chain, but don't quite know how. You know, and there's more and more and more. And I think that our drive and what we're supposed to do is to create opportunities for those people, find those people, make those people visible. And that's what you speak to.
Well, I really appreciate hearing that from you. You know, we talked about lived experience, and I was sharing with you the book discussion group that I was in a couple years ago on how to be an anti-racist, for example. And that's a nonfiction book that's a very, very good source for those who want to understand better how to learn about others that are different than they are and how to engage with them and everything. But, you know, someone else told me in the middle of that conversation, what you really need to do is, more than reading nonfiction, read fiction. And so that's how you learn about people's lived experience. And so when I thought about that for a second, I think I may have shared with you, I'm an English major by background. And I went back and looked at my curriculum for English language and literature and the things that I was reading back in college. And there were literally only two, and this is at the University of Michigan, there were literally only two African-American authors in the whole canon of books that I was required to read during college. And that was Ishmael Reed, and that was Toni Morrison. And so the summer before last, Dr. Caesar and I got together and we said, you know, how do we want to take this next level? And so we're talking about lived experience. And so I decided to create a summer reading list. And for that summer, all I read were fiction books by African Americans. Right. And there were so many that give you such a profound sense of what you're talking about. I think about Ernest Gaines, you know, and his book on As I Lay Dying, about the man who's about to die and his recognition on what he needs to do to become a man up until his final breath. And I think about other books. Toni Morrison comes to mind, Maya Angelou. But, you know, you're referencing basically the storyline of Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man. And I think, you know, I think that's what the blessing of being in our community is about, and being disrupted in the D is all about, because this city has become so diverse. And if you live in the city, if you breathe in this city, you can't help but meet people who are different than you are. And I think that's so important, because a lot of times when you're doing that, you have a different appreciation and a different empathy for other people's experiences. Right. you know, I was sharing with you the daily indignities that a very good colleague of mine faced as an African-American successful business executive, where he was pulled over because he was driving a luxury car and no one believed, none of the police believed that it was his right. car. And that's just profoundly wrong. So you're right. I think it is a larger, there's a larger aperture to this, and that is finding people and making sure that they are seen and they are made visible. Right. And I think the other thing you do that is so extraordinary, Al, is you look for these people and then you look to give them their next chance. And I wouldn't say a second right. chance. It could be a third, fourth, or fifth, but you give them their next chance. And I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, how you came to this perspective, because you grew up in the rural yes. South and you grew up on a farm and now you're in the heart of manufacturing. And I think it's such a fantastic, you know, such an interesting journey that you've taken. And I think our readership, you know, those who are listening and viewing us would love to hear that story. So if you can share a little bit about your origin story, I think it sort of informs this conversation.
Okay. We're having. Thank you. Thank you. I grew up in South Georgia, a little town called Portal, Georgia. Probably 60 miles from the coast from Savannah. And we were farmers. We have had our farm in our family for over 130 years. We were celebrated as a centennial farm probably 25 years ago and in the state of Georgia. You know, I grew up on hard work. You know, as farmers, there's always work to do. We raise crops, we raise tobacco, corn, cotton, peanuts, soybean, all those things, and we had cattle. I can never remember not eating. I mean, because we raised everything. But I found out that based on the statistics in America that my family was poor. I didn't know we were poor, you know, based on how much money we made. But we didn't need to make a lot of money because we grew everything. And in the neighborhood, they thought that we were well-to-do. But 20 years later, when I was looking through my mother's and father's tax, their taxes, I saw what they made. And I like, wow, how did we do what we did? Well, you know, growing up in the South as a black farmer, in the early 80s, late 70s, it got really difficult. And my mother was a strong black woman that told my father, you know, I'm going to go and get a city job. And my father was one to say, hey, you know, a very proud black man to say, hey, look, you're farming. We're going to be OK. We're going to come out of this drought and we're going to be OK. And my mother said, you know, Last year, that drought started and it ruined the farm, ruined the crops. So, you know, this year we can't risk it. I need to go get a city job. So my dad said, okay. So my mother got a job at a gray iron foundry. And this gray iron foundry, there weren't many women working at this foundry. And my mother took on a job as a man. I mean, she worked like a man in this foundry. And my mother was one of those about 5'10", 5'11", church women, strong. And at 12 years old, I never seen my mother that dirty. So we went to pick her up from work, and she was so soiled from her hard hat to her steel-toe boots. And so soiled that she couldn't even get into the car until she took off her shoes. And first question I asked, I said, Mom, are you tired? And she said, yeah, I'm tired. I said, you know, the weather's changing. We're getting rain now. We're going to have a good farming year. You don't have to work here. She said that, yeah, I hear you. I don't have to work here now, but I have to work here just to prove that women can do this kind of work so we have more opportunities. I said, okay. I said, how do they treat you in there? She said, the way I let them treat me. I said, okay. I said, you know, one day I'm going to buy this business and I'm going to show them how to treat people. And she looked at my dad and she said, I think that would be good. Well, 30 years later, I retired from GM, who taught me so much. And I'll tell the GM stories about how they educated me in manufacturing and all those things. I retired from GM early. And what did I do? I bought that business and signed the documents on her birthday. Now, my mother...
That is amazing, yeah. Al.
My mother died my senior year in college. I graduated from Indiana Wesleyan, but somehow I think she still knows. And
she knows. Yeah, absolutely.
So that was my first acquisition. But, you know, coming from a farm life, you know, entrepreneurship is always there. Even when I was at GM, I worked at GM as though it was my company. And GM, I mean, it's hard to work at GM and not learn things. They continually take you through classes, training. And it was so good for me. And I love to work. You know, I don't ever see myself retiring. I just see myself, transitioning to my kids, running the business, and I run, I'm in and out. But not to get off subject here, that story about my mom resonate with me because it taught me that it's not all about you. It's about the people you represent. You know, my mother was working that job so other women could work that job. Her first was to work that job to take care of us. The second, since we're in it, the crop is good this year. I still need to work this job so they know other women can do a good job at this. When I bought the facility, there were more women in that facility, and I hired even more. So that's kind of my origin. My grandfather was on the farm. We had so many different revenue streams that we had a little country store. My grandfather was one of the first black Gulf oil dealer filling stations. So we sold gas, we sold meat, we did all of the above. And when we killed slaughtered hogs for the consumption, my grandfather would say, okay, we need to slaughter three or four more. There are more people coming to help, and everybody need to leave here with meat. So it was always like a community. I was taught that. I don't know any different, you know. And, there's things that I do here that are the similar things that my grandfather and my father used to do. And I'll give you an example. Looking at the workforce and bringing in all kinds of people, one of the things that we put in place was the weekend warriors. And what's a weekend warrior? This is an individual that want to come in and work maybe a Friday and a Saturday. Okay. All right. So who are those people? These are grandmothers, grandfathers, aunts and uncles. These are people that have a job and maybe want to make a little bit more, and the work is not that difficult. So they come in as a weekend warrior and work. Now, where did I get that concept from? On the farm, we, like I said, we raised everything. We raised cotton, we raised tobacco, we raised everything. And there was only three kids in my family, my brother and sister who are twins, and myself. There's no way we could do all the work. So my daddy was a very excitable man and passionate about things. And everybody in 3, 4, 5 counties that just loved my dad. And my dad used to get buses and get people from all over, and they would come and work on our farm with us. But he had one rule, and that rule was we could not allow anyone to outwork us. We had to be the lead dog. We had to work harder than them. We had to show them what it was all about. And we always had help. So the weekend warriors, that's a concept that came, I named it Weekend Warriors, but that came from some of the things that I learned along the way.
Well, you know, Al, you've been, you know, so blessed, as have I, to have these really strong life lessons. And I think we shared this between us, that both of us had very strong women in our lives. My grandmother was a Rosie the Riveter, who started out on the factory floor during the war because she was doing volunteer work. And she said, you know, I'm working 40 hours a week and I'm not getting paid. So she went down during the war, got a job in the factory. I asked her years later, she reminds me of your stories about your mom, because I asked her years later, you know, I understand why you went to work in the factory during the war, but why did you stay there after the war? And she said, well, you know, I was looking at all the men around and I thought, you know, this work isn't that hard and they need to see that I can do it too. It's a very similar story. So, Al, what I want to do is pivot to our conversation about how you're taking these stories and these life lessons and translating them into your talent strategy at Wolverine. But before that, we're going to do a quick break. So listen, nerds and viewers, stay tuned. We're going to have episode 2 in a minute here to hear more about how these lifelong lessons have shaped Al's vision about talent in a very disrupted manufacturing world. Stay tuned. You're going to want to hear more. Thank you. We'll be right back. Folks, Ron here again with just a quick update. Before we take you to episode 2, we just want to provide a quick highlight about Gentex, the exciting company that owns a minority interest in Wolverine Assemblies. Well worth your time. Check this out.
Obviously, we're in the midst of a little bit of a labor shortage, and so Gentex is trying to get creative in how we attract and retain people. So we've got a couple new initiatives. One of them is a Spanish-speaking assembly line. So back earlier this year, we started to prepare all of the training, recruiting, onboarding, and supervisory infrastructure we needed to support Spanish-speaking assembly line members. Started to bring them on board, and now we're to the point where we've got over 50 Spanish-speaking folks on the assembly line, and we're looking to continue to expand that in order to tap into a new market of employees within West Michigan. And in a very cool way, it aligns with some of our diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, be able to open up to a new population, provide employment path at Gentex to people who might not otherwise have those opportunities.
I work as a production supervisor, and I'm working directly with the Spanish-speaking lines. I'm helping out also well with the recruit team, making sure that everybody feels welcome here when they start off, no matter the language. So we are happy to onboard any Spanish speakers that may want to come over to work at Gentex.